Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. The agenda. We are having a presentation by FFC on 2019 Special Appropriations Bill. Before we proceed with an agenda and fund of us, are there any apologies?
Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members and guests. No apologies except for Ms. Peters, who will be joining the meeting.
Thank you. Thank you. Just before we proceed, you see that on my left wing, we are having a brand new content advisor. And listen carefully. He is Mr. Sfiso Matakula.
Wow.
Okay. So I've got my namesake next to me. Sfiso, welcome. Well, he's quite familiar with the environment because he was at the MCOP. Oh, no, he was at COP. A person who has been doing what he's doing is Kilian Jomo, who's at the NCOP. So, welcome. Looking forward to working with you. Prof, can you allow me to take us through your presentation?
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members. Thank you for the opportunity that you gave us to do this presentation. Well, we'll try to do, I see there's not nothing on the screen, so I hope everybody has received a copy of our slide presentation, but also the narrative, which helps to explain some of the things that's in the slide, so that we don't have an obscure conversation.
So the problem, I think I should have said that we're having a problem with the so can I just make sure that everybody is having the slides on the paper presentation? Okay. Again, I also, and I wish I agree, I received a complaint before this that, Chair, why do you bring us into such a small committee meeting room? And I said, get allocated. The Chair has got no option on this one. Let's try to. I'm sure they just want us to make us uncomfortable as we deal with the special appropriation. Okay. Yeah, please.
Thank you, Chair. It's also hidden from the public. That's what I was saying. The presentation that we're going to do is essentially looking at the introduction, overview of the ESCOM's financial position, details of implications of government support strategy, the Commission's proposed measures to improve ESCOM sustainability, and then we'll talk generally about what are we recommending. See, I think a key thing that we said is that the substantive part of our recommendation deals with subjects rather is got to do with the risks that the country is facing around ESCOM and the implications of that. And then the latter part looks at our recommendations with regard to how do we see matters going forward. And then there's a third, which is not on the slide, and also in the narrative, and we'll update the narrative, where we'll give some ideas as to how to strengthen institutional arrangements around guarantees, especially on the related framework issues, the institutional requirements around it, and then some things that need to be done with regard to the strengthening the link between the government's framework, management framework, and the oversight of SOEs in relation to subnational governments in particular. One is referring to municipalities as the institutions that's responsible for the Chair, I think it's always useful to give a reminder to committees why we do these presentations and some ratification and also raising the legal, constitutional legal matters to it. We're making this presentation in terms of Section 4, Subsection 4C of that long word which is essentially the Parliamentary Act on budgets, which requires parliamentary committees to consider any recommendations of the FSC and deliberate on that in terms of the money bills. The second to that, to the old question of the Money Bills Amendment Procedures and Related Matters Act, is it's made in terms of the FSC Act of 97 as amended, which requires us to respond to any requests or recommendations by an organ of state on any financial and or fiscal matters relevant to this police mandate. I'm not going to go into the FSC because I think we have had quite 4 or 5 hours the last time we did the orientation to let members know what the FSC is all about. And again, thank you for that opportunity given. The 2009 Appropriation Bill annually over the medium term to support ESCOM during its reconfiguration and restructuring. The Commission briefed the Commission, the Committee of Parliament, on the 10th of June on the 2019 Appropriation Bill. On the 2nd of April, we think that's important from our perspective, the Minister of Finance invoked Section 16 of the Public Finance Management Act and authorized the payment of 5 billion to ESCOM to service its debt and to meet its obligations immediately. Section 16 is quite a significant authority and facility that provides the Minister of Finance, and we will come back to that. On the 23rd of July, the Minister of Finance presented his special preparation to Parliament, seeking an additional financial support for ESCOM at 26 billion in 2019-20 and 33 billion in 2021. This obviously gives a consolidated amount of for the 2 years of 59 million rand towards ESCOM. The situation around ESCOM and the context around its operations is basically, I believe Tracy would have told you that. Which is slide 2. I'm just going to quickly give an overview on it. The economy is at a minus 3.2% growth. The performance of the economy is very poor. The risk to the fiscal framework in terms of the special appropriation and, of ESCOM, it must not be underestimated. And I think every time there's a special appropriation coming up for ESCOM, the storyline doesn't change. It's always about the risk that ESCOM presents to the fiscus. And it's quite worrisome that some of these guarantees are given to deal with operational matters. And as a result of dealing with operational matters, it has a knock-on effect on other infrastructure investments of the institution. We are concerned, as the whole of government and as the whole of South African society, that the ESCOM sovereign is so much embedded and entrenched, and is a structural to a solid link between the ESCOM debt and its ratings in the international market and South Africa's sovereign. So we actually find ourselves as a country in a catch-22 situation when it comes to ESCOM. You do, you damn if you don't, you damn if you do. So that's the storyline of ESCOM in terms of the public domain. But if we don't do it, we will be in serious trouble. In fact, if we don't do it, it increases the threat, if you like, the risk of needing to go borrow money from multinational, multilateral organizations. You know which organizations I'm talking about. It's been banded around, in particular the International Monetary Fund. And the International Monetary Fund support and intervention doesn't come with flimsy, soft conditions. It comes with hard conditions. And it will, if you don't stay away from that space, it's like pushing back if you have a particular lifestyle disease, and if you don't push back on it, it's going to get into that space and it's going to take long for you to get out of it. So we need to push back on any possibilities of government getting some rescue funds from an institution like the International Monetary Fund, because the conditions for the elders and it will have a dent on our sovereign. We're also making this point that it's important that the energy class, administration, and when I talk about the administration, I'm talking about both in the two branches of government, in the executive and within parliament, start to look at collectively how do we deal with the ESCOM as a matter. It cannot be a singular view as the Minister of Public Enterprises responsibility all these years, or the Minister of Energy, or when it comes to difficulty, continuously being the Treasury and getting into a hand into the fiscus. So there needs to be an energy cluster orientation to deal with this. And the same we would advise for Parliament on this. This is not a matter for the Committee of Public Enterprises. Energy or the others that deals with this matter. It's a matter for the energy cluster. The portfolio committees, I would suggest, where the leaders are provided by the appropriations committee. So I'm even suggesting to you, like we're trying to do it on the 600 issue that I raised with you the last time, that if this committee starts this process, in fact, this committee, other as opposed to previous committees of the three last parliaments, has got the greatest opportunity to steer the course here. There's a path dependency between a bailout provided through a guarantee and the role of the public representatives in terms of making sure that bailout yield the necessary terms. And I've made the point that we don't see that those returns every time there's a rescue. And this is not the first of this kind. Chairperson, I just want to talk to you quickly through the hearing lines on the government guarantees by ESCOM. That we, as I mentioned to you, ESCOM's substantial risk to the public finance and economy at large, and the risk specifically linked to the sovereign. I've tried in the early mornings to be able to see whether this is a symbiotic relationship, a synergy between the two. I actually don't know what to call it, because if you don't, we drop. We don't miss and our economy is heavily responsible, or rather heavily dependent on the economy. So So for us, Eskom is neither financially sustainable, nor able to meet the country's economic needs. In fact, we think that if there's not a substantive material intervention that changes the course of Eskom and where Eskom is going, it's going to continue to fuel government debt. We see that the debt has reached of Eskom, the gross loan debt has reached a level of 2.8 trillion, or 55% of the gross domestic product. This is a problem, especially last year, the end of last year. And it's expected to stabilize 60.2% of GDP by 2023-2024. But that's not our number. That's a number that comes out of the budget review, the National Treasury's budget review that was tabled this year. So we see that the materialization of the associated ESCOM contingent liability could increase government debt to the highest risk benchmark of 70% of GDP. Over the medium term, and guarantee the state-owned companies standing at the whopping level of 529.4 billion, of which ESCOM's debt, or rather ESCOM's share of the bank, is 55.7. Now surely you can't have a single public entity that has got more than half of the total of state-owned enterprises. So there's a need for this intervention to ensure that there's a materialization of the ESCOM contingency liability. Also the point that we'll be making is that Eskom finances show that most of its resources has to serve the service debt, rather has to service the debt. And the ability to do so, the fiscal space to do so, even based on the revenue collection, is limited. Consequently, Eskom might have to resort to borrowing to fund operating costs, which may make the servicing of its debt even more difficult. And with government gives a guarantee, government gives a guarantee to an institution, it then says that go out into the money market, domestic and international, with other money. And the last intervention that was made by government to ESCOM was when there was a threat that ESCOM is not going to be able to serve its debt, its loans that it's got, and as a result there will be a breaching of the loan conditions. Mm-hmm. And we all know what banks do if you can't pay your loans. Especially when the ones that pay more substantive, then they will call on the government guarantees. So the government guarantees the ESCOM on average for almost three quarters stands at around 74% of the total government guarantee to all public institutions. That's 350 billion between 2015, 16 and 2018. Government guarantee exposures to ESCOM is increased by 69% from 124.6 billion in 2015 to 204.7 billion in 2018. And the reason why I talk so slowly is because I took you to the slide and made the slide tell the story further graphically to to your honourable members, Jefferson. So, government guarantees are critical for Eskom because without them, the energy utility struggles to access funding from capital markets. So, at the institution level, the government level, somebody would serve as a guarantor of a loan that a state institution will make. Government is responsible for it, and government will have based on its currently projected tax base of revenue that it will have to be able to house services. We see a significant increase constitutes a risk of sustainability of the fiscus, and it's a big challenge to the sovereign again. And the reason why I'm raising the sovereign question, this is not about Eskom only, it's also about the sovereign. And we need to ensure whatever this committee agrees to in support of what government is saying, this committee makes sure that the conditions are in place that will turn around, this time around at least, what Eskom is doing. And we talk about later about how we see the conditions that need to be locked into the performance contracts from the CEO down to the middle manager in this one. Because these are top heavy organizations in terms of management. We can always debate whether Eskom has made a profit or not these years, because it's always been a question that has been asked, was there a profit, wasn't there a profit? And we think sometimes Eskom is the only people to explain this. But let me just add to that. In the previous work that I did for government as the chair of the Special Advisory Committee to deal with the debt between Eskom and municipalities, information on the Eskom side is quite hard to get by. Where is the Treasury asking for it? Where is this committee asking for it? In fact, I had to threaten people on the grid for them and the current president, if we don't give us information, I'm just going to go to the president to say, we're not getting Eskom to cooperate, providing this information on its balance book, but also the liabilities it's creating, the costing and pricing of energy, and the structural inequities between big companies and the citizens. We have the view that like most state-owned companies, Eskom is facing a negative cash flow problem. And because of it, it's also financing its operations from debt, which is becoming increasingly difficult to raise. So there's a negative cash flow problem that speaks to the health of Eskom. There's also, in terms of our assessment of Eskom annual reports, and Chair, you would remember that annually, in another capacity I served, there was always problems to know when Eskom's annual reports will be finalized, the auditing of those reports, and so on and so forth. And some of the stuff comes 6 months, sometimes a year after financial year. So the report shows that, looking at Eskom's own report, that there was a profit apparently in 2014 of 9.3 billion. to a loss of 20.7 billion in 2019. So there's a lot of profit losses there. You take the information as good. The decline in response profitability has occurred despite increasing revenue as a result of NERSA. Now NERSA is the regulator, the National Energy Regulator, that every year looks at tariffs. And you know that there was at times good relationship between Eskom and NERSA. But recently, the relationship has created problems to the extent that some of these things are invalid in the High Court. Because of Eskom's contest that the NERSA tariffs are out of sync with what Eskom has presented to them. Lastly, if Eskom is granted a tariff increase, the expectation is that the concurrent increase in revenue would be expected. So if the tariffs go up, then it's expected that the revenue part of your income is going to go up. However, what we've seen is that revenue increases have consistently been less than tariffs and the tariff adjustments. So there's a revenue generation problem, a collection problem. Some of it sits in the political space of it, some of it sits in political meaning, the relationship of Eskom, the government has with the citizens, on the developmental agenda of Eskom, which is one of it, which also makes the difficulties there. And I think it's a right for citizens to have access to electricity, energy and electricity. But on the other hand, it's got to do with the structural differences between how much Eskom charges corporations and charges. We also see that the poor performance of sales does not completely explain the significant deceleration of profits. Because while revenue is increasing, in tandem with the revenue increase in tariffs granted by NERSA, it remains a positive matter. This means that increased operating costs and an aggressive bulk program are the main drivers of a declining profit. So the point is that correctly so, there was an aggressive program of needing to build a number of power stations in the country. The question is, what were the conditions of those funds? Those loans given to that. So we see a poor performance on the sales side of it. Chair, then, if we look at the net assets, which is the next slide, generally the point is that the growth in Eskom liabilities is outstripping that of its assets. Essentially this means that your liabilities are becoming far more than your assets, the net value of your assets are. The liabilities have grown at an average of 8.3% between 2014 and 2019. Compared to 7.4% for the assets over the same period.
Just jump on that slide, Prof. The slide number 9, hey?
If my eyes are not very clear, sir.
Yeah, I think there's a typo error there. Mm. It's 8.9, which is 8.9 assets.
Yeah.
So we are saying that let's correct that one.
Yep.
Assets are concerned.
Please do, because this slide was presented to this committee. I didn't pick it up because it's not just crafting this morning or last night. Because this slide was presented also to the committee when it is the appropriation.
That's fine, Prof. I just want us to correct that number.
Please do check.
What's the number again?
It's supposed to be 8.3% between 2014 and 2019. Because the data has also changed. So rather take the data I'm giving you now, Chairperson.
You know what the slide is saying?
Yes.
It's saying the assets grow at the same rate like in Abidjan. Yeah, 8.9%, and I don't think that's what you want
to
say.
7.4,
as far as the assets are concerned.
Yeah.
So liabilities grew more than the assets. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the So I would just identify by saying, Chairperson, you correct? Just for the record, the liabilities have grown at an average annual of 8.3% between 2014 and 2019. So this is between 2014 and 2018. Right? So I'm just correcting that whole line if you don't mind. Okay? So 8.3% between 2014 and 2019. That's on liabilities. Compared to 7.4% of assets over the same period, which is also from 2014 to 2019. So you're right, the outstanding labor, that's on the old number. My apologies. Please accept my apologies. Then I thought it's important that we thought it important to talk about the Eskom debt ratios, the debt to equity ratio. It's a leverage ratio that measures the weight of functional debt and financial liabilities against the total shareholders' equity. What we've seen there is an increase from 2 in 2013-2014 to 3.1 in 2018-2019. When we talk about a debt service ratio, which actually measures the cash flow available to pay current debt obligations, you see the service ratio decrease from 1.2.4 between 2013-2014 to 0.47 between 2018-2019. This means, in terms of the
statement,
Yes,
I think we need to the slide that we're having and the narrative that we're having in this other document, the one that you are reading from. For instance, you compare figures of 2014 to 2019 in the document that you are reading from, whereas in the slide it's 2014-2018 and it's found to some discrepancies. So if we could try and just make sure that we have got the same number. Okay, I'm just going to let you attention it because it would be nice if you bring back a slide which talks to what you are reading from. You get my point?
Yeah, I get your point. That's why I don't like slides, you know? What we'll do is that we will fix where it's fixed to make it correct in that. But the narrative is the dominant document here. That's why I always prefer the narrative document. And the slide sometimes is faster. And my apologies. This is not good. But the story that we're telling is to be able to distill the project. And I'm asking for your further indulgence on it. On the debt service ratio, before I give the number, let's probably check again. Okay, I'm clear there. Is that Eskom has not operated? It means that Eskom's net operating income to cover only 4%, 47% of this annual debt. That's the correct problem. payment obligations. The other measure that we thought is important is the cash flow interest over ratios. Cover the issue in the ratio measures the ease with which an organization can pay interest on its outstanding debt. ESCOM's cash interest cover ratio declined from 2.5 in 2013-14 to 0.94 in 2018-19. Since this ratio has deteriorated to less than 1, it means that ESCOM is not generating enough income to pay its interest on debt. And that was the point I was making earlier. So the issue on EBITDA, which actually looks at earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. The ratio measures the ability of an organization to cover its short-term and long-term debt. What we've seen is that it accelerated from 11.7% in 2013-2014 to 15.64% in 2018-2019. When the ratio is higher than 4 or 5, it means that an organization is likely to face difficulties in handling its debt burden. In summary, what we're saying here on this analysis is that ESCOM's financial situation indicates that ESCOM is increasing financing its operations through debt versus equity funding. Its debt to equity, cash interest cover, debt service cover, gross debt to EBITDA ratios, which are some measure of interim cash flow to cover debt servicing and the ability to pay debt, are all high in relation to industry. So it's quite difficult to look at the comparison in our situation, but also within the country. Then, the implications for us. On this one, I prefer to stick to the sheet, which is the slide show, Jefferson, if you don't mind. The Commission understands that the energy crisis is perhaps the biggest risk to the 2019 appropriation goal. On the positive side, the bailout sends positive signals to investors that government is committed to resolving the energy crisis, but also to ensure recovery of ESCOM. Investors will appreciate the fact that ESCOM will not be allowed to collapse. The citizens will be happy, sad, and hopefully through this process you will tighten the conditions to make sure that this process yields the necessary returns on the government guarantees and income to other guarantees given. The support will ensure that ESCOM is up to date with debt obligations and be able to access financial markets in the future. On the negative side, the $59 billion bailout is going to compound the risk caused by economic growth and development by ESCOM. Because this obviously cuts where government could have invested in other much needed activities, but because those other investments are dependent on ESCOM's capability to provide energy and electricity. It's something that cuts really too. We have the view that it poses a greater risk ESCOM to government's contingent liabilities. And here we want to indicate that 72.4% of selected state-owned enterprises. That's the share of ESCOM's government guarantees. That is probably at the lower end if you don't compare it with all the others that get the big ones that get government guarantees. Then the 295 billion ESCOM guarantees out of 229 billion, which is in 2018-2019. That number increases to 306 billion out of the 552 billion. Now, I'm not so sure whether the researcher of this committee or the content advisor who's responsible for it have given you, honorable members, two things. One, there's a table in the budget review, because you can't deal with this if you don't read the budget review. That speaks to the 72.4%. And it's a thing that speaks on government guarantees. I'm also not sure whether the researcher or content advisor has given you a spreadsheet. I think it's an A3 spreadsheet if you've gone through. It's also in the budget review. And for the sake of fast tracking where they can find it and what it's called a net loan debt provision and contingent liabilities. It's in the 2019 budget review. And the reason I'm raising it is because I see it only as it has a sheet that's going to be you have to have that sheet in front of you so that you can actually see what is the total picture on government guarantees. Where's the big ones, where and how the declining effect of it, because it shows the total government exposure on loan debt and contingent liabilities. And some of those contingent liabilities is a carry through of it. And part of that is for you to be able then to see where are the risks, because ESCOM is not it. Only a risk. I mean, ESCOM is the biggest risk, and not the only one. And I think the ESCOM special appropriation will result in a widening gap of the budget deficit, especially considering also that poor economic growth will result in revenue undercorrection. And the point is clear because it's part of the course of the path of this committee that you're concerned about the revenue expenditure. The ESCOM bailout will also result in the widening gap of government to GDP on the spending side of it. Taken together, the above points simplify that the bailout will further put South Africa's investment status at risk, and we need to protect that downgrade, whatever that downgrade means, because I think we are in waters where we think we understand the high risk to the economy, to the South African society at large. The above worrisome situation will be compounded by the fact that bailout is not anchored in the sound and motive plan or strategy to get ESCOM out of the doldrums into the sustainable growth path. The reason why we're raising this is you can't have a situation where every year a state-owned company comes for a bailout. There has to be some measures in place that says no more further. And we think that while we agree with the I don't know what to call it, because ideological. I'm not just sure whether I'm a reformist or whether I'm a transformationist, but this committee will not use reformers and transformationists in this committee. This transformation can be big, and that can also temper on just tinkering on the fringes of things. If the unbundling that was suggested by the president of generation, transmission, distribution, one needs to have further details into it, because it's hard to venture into that conversation. Adequately, it's a policy evidence-based institution. If you don't know, as yet, as to what is the plan around it, and what's the content of that, not what's the net effect, what's the projected net effect that will have on this format, and consequently on the overall energy sector and the economy as a whole. We are concerned that that there's a leadership and management void in at ISCOM, like in all other places where we find these things. There is a chief restructuring officer who I'm not so sure whether it's permanent or acting or secondment, but only ISCOM and the board who are able to answer that particular question. There's no CEO to work with. By the chief executive officer, by the chief restructuring reorganization officer. It's not on the slide, but in this document that we gave you, we are concerned about the needing to speak truth to the situation that the chair of the board and the CEO of ISCOM is on the service, because it adds risk for governance of this institution. And it would be useful, I think, if this committee can get from where has made the decision, because I don't know where the decision was made, because we're trying to scratch why the two put the two together. It might be a new way of doing things, but if that's the case, then it means the legislative changes of ISCOM establishment need to go hand in hand with that. So I want to recommend to this committee that when you look at the appropriation, you need to look at these internal structural issues around the governance, leadership and management of this institution. And you also need to link that to the Establishment Act of ESCOM. And your researchers or content advisors must look at this. Researchers in particular. Because the act is simple, it's just called the ESCOM Companies Act. And it says how this institution was established and what happens in that space. I'm going to jump that slide that talks about bailout, because I'm going to sound too repetitive. The measures to improve ESCOM sustainability. We think that the following operational actions is required or should be considered. Reducing the cost.
I understand that you don't want also to be rhetorical.
Yeah.
But much as you jump as large as you could, because in your narrative,
okay,
there is a sentence there that it will be for the first time that you utter the committee, your 4.6, please.
Okay, Chairperson, let me rather not keep quiet. you know what happens with bailouts? Bailouts, you get somebody into jail. It's like Monopoly, you get somebody into jail, you bail them out, and putting money into it, and you're losing out on that because you haven't budgeted for that. And there's some other thoughts that I've got on bringing these things together. The Eskom boiler has the potential to crowd out other infrastructure investments. It is unproductive government spending. The bailout monies will come from somewhere. Obviously the tax rate. Obviously there will be a need to reprioritize. When I used to work many years ago in the National Treasury, we used to call it Umarabaraba. You know, the game, you take from me, give to each other.
Rob Peter to pay boss.
That's the English version, honorable member, and the biblical version. That's what I'm talking about. So obviously there will be reprioritization and cuts. Cuts on other expenditure items. I mean, to the Treasury's credit, they've actually raised this money. In different fora around it. Our greatest worry is the potential impact it will have on service delivery and expansion of certain areas we're starting. But we think this committee is the needs to become the holy grail on some of these matters. I'm not serious on this. Committee and the Finance Committee, your task, honorable chairperson, is going to be difficult over the next 2 to 3 years to help us get back on the right path of economic growth, but in particular spending priorities, revenue generation, making sure that there's value, the real value for money, because we spoke about value for money. In the years of President Nelson Mandela, we're still talking about it. We still don't know what we're talking about and where we can actually heal those deficiency cases. So we do think that needs to happen. So the Commission, we didn't propose that we need to look at reducing the cost of current and additional IPP contracts. The cost of transporting coal, as well as cost associated with coal, to the UK to the international markets. Part of this is the openness that is required around these contracts, and the conditionalities within these contracts, and the implication of these contracts to the fiscus, and the risk of it to the fiscus, and the benefits of it. So you might want to consider, honourable chairperson and members, the appropriation, but we're suggesting that this is more than just the appropriation of making sure 59 million is given. It's also got to do with how you then fulfill that gap in making sure that the transfers given to this institution or the guarantees given to this institution is going to yield those returns. It doesn't matter who's in charge of this thing. In fact, truth be told, we need. And it's not a nice thing to say. What did you say the last time, Jay? Where you sit is where you stand when you make a certain comment, isn't it? Right. I used to sit on the other side and not sit on the other side. The reason I'm making a comment is that if you read the state-owned company's specific establishment acts, these institutions are more powerful than the shareholders. More powerful than the representative of the shareholder. there wasn't much politics in it, you know the consequences, the consequent issues about it. Because of the authority, the structural problem in that the law creates, because you can bring the company law to bear on it, you can bring the PFMA to bear on it, you can bring the state establishment law to bear on it. You can even bring all the king's reports. Power and the authority is greater on the side of the CEO and the board of Eskom relative to the shareholder. So when you consider these things, it helps to talk when there's no cameras. acceleration of the deferred infrastructure maintenance program. I don't know, it's really a South African problem. I don't know why we never look at maintenance of anything.
Yeah.
We will invest, we will get Sunrail or whatever institution, Eskom, a lot to go borrow money to build these things, but there's no maintenance plan built into it and maintenance costing into it. So we think that you need to consider that as a matter. Acceleration of outsourcing of non-core services. And the reason, I would rather stand for this, but I'm speaking for the commission. You know, outsourcing is ideological issues. This is sometimes we need to be pragmatic, financial people and economists in our space and policy people, but there's a need to look at that. The problem always with this, which is nothing, is that when you talk about right sizing and rationalization, it's always the people at the bottom that we talk about. Because management normally deals with right sizing, rationalization, and retrenchment, but they never look at themselves. Maybe just speed up the recruitment of a permanent CEO. I think you need to consider putting a time for it, and if whoever is here from our sister, brother, organizations will probably say this man is crazy, but they need to be crazy. I think you need to put a time for it. Because it's how Parliament needs to see whether it helps to restore the institution, but also helps to ensure that there's stability in the management of it. And obviously the policy clarity around the chief restructuring officer. And the right-sizing program again. There needs to be clarity, more predictability on future government financial support from Eskom to enhance future financial planning. I think, I'm not so sure whether the PBO can help for this, whether Siraj in particular and others, Dr. Siraj Muhammad and others in Parliament, are crazy, but there's a need to have a long range view on guarantees in Eskom so that you are able to predict now already whether in the third year, which means after this guarantee, whether there's going to be a need to look at the fiscal financial and fiscal risks that Eskom is going to face or not face. Because the restructuring might see there's a panacea to deal with the problem. In fact, the restructuring will, while it's a government articulated policy between by the president, it also raises more other issues than this. Many would argue the discussion is correct because it's going to make service efficiency gains properly yielded within the system. There's going to be a different part to it. I would say, restructuring as a pathway towards further privatization. Because that's the international experience. You shouldn't hide from it. It's a policy decision that the executive was made with your inputs into it. But it's a policy decision that requires further contestation, because I think when the president of this country speak of the state of the nation, it's not their state of the nation, it's the state of the nation of the people. And the president said destruction. So the point I'm making, on the one hand, it's going to probably yield all the institutions as expected. It's going to create uncertainties on what each different arms going to do, generation, transmission and distribution. There are constitutional questions on one hand when it comes to municipalities, but it's one can probably just kick that can down the road so that the appropriation gets dealt with. And then there's the question, what happens after the destruction? So one needs to be acutely aware of it. We also propose that the conditions consider for the 2019 ESCOM appropriation law. The bailout should be linked directly to the executive and non-executive performance agreement and performance contracts of, on the one end of the, there's a structural issue here. The board, the government, and part of the board with government is the special appropriation. And then the board with the CEO, and then the CEO with the management, middle management, top management. In fact, anybody who's got management behind his name must be connected to the successful appropriation. Because it's not going to help you sitting in this and in this, everybody must. So there needs to be this catharsis that needs to get into the system of ESCOM. It can't be business as usual, it's a new process to follow. Operational decisions should be preserved by only for the executive management to facilitate the achievement of autonomy. ESCOM should be subjected to regular and intense public oversight by this committee, because you approving the appropriation, we suggesting humbly, I don't know how to do it, but it's because you honorable humbly suggesting that this committee must do it, Chairperson. And I think that the capacity of this around this committee needs to be enhanced. Because you're gonna deal with so many things related to this progression and other progressions. Oversight by committees of parliament to quarterly reports. Now even those reports, when it gets to you, can't just be a report, because we've seen it over time. Quarterly reports to committees agrees to it. And the status quo. So there's no turnaround in the system of other entities. I mean, the same goes for us. I mean, if you ask us for a monitoring report, we'll give it to you. And I'm actually happy that you read the slides, because you picked up the numbers, which makes me nervous about your committee. Because another committee is, if you don't read, I mean, I've been involved in provincial legislature, the stuff goes. So this committee is tasked. You seized with this responsibility, I think, greater than other kinds that you'll find in the House of Parliament. Oversight should be subjected to regular and intense public oversight by committees, Parliament, the quarterly report, underlining the milestones reached in relation to the prescribed set of performance indicators. We are saying that Appropriation Act and the others that have been approved by committees like yourselves need to come into this space. And that your content advisor and your researcher, and we will assist. I don't want to volunteer there, but the PBO must also come in and assist on this thing, because the appropriation stands on its own, but there's a dependency part between all of us. It's all of us together creates the risk. So we need to see what has been done, what has been agreed in the first, the second, third, fourth, etc., so it can be properly monitored. And the monitoring needs to happen with all those parties involved in this appropriation. We also saying that we need to accelerate the legislative and regulated frameworks for energy transitions towards cheaper renewable power generation and associated technologies, because we see people getting off the grid and it's going to be too high risk for ESCOM and for the municipality in particular. There's also a need to look at the whole question about how the legislative regulatory framework for unbundling ESCOM into the three areas as identified by the present state of the nation: generation, transmission, high levels of inefficiency at the ESCOM level due to monopoly situation, we know that. There's a virtual monopoly on power generation. All inefficiencies associated with absence of competition are evident in it. It's the old story. There needs to be more players in generation space, but government must still control this as the public good. Because otherwise, in a country with so much inequities that we have, and stubborn poverty, we need to be cautious as to what decisions are taken. Because President Mandela was clear in 1995 when he said, access, and we need to roll out ESCOM, and ESCOM has to get to do all these things, because there was no time to make sure that historically black areas have lacked the energy. On tariff disparities, the point that we're making is that our energy utility ESCOM has different tariffs for different customers, a phenomenon that has potential to lower emissions. Although industry and mining sectors together consume 60% of electricity produced in the country, and residential consumers 16 to 18%, the mining industrial customers are charged lower prices than the Gogo down the road. The Gogo gets a social grant for its pension. The household, where there's a total social weight going to the household to make sure that it's able to deal with the economic shock that the household is experiencing. There's a need to ensure, so the point is that if you engage whoever on this, they need to be able to start telling you. And you're probably going to hear that you're venturing into the space of the Energy Committee. My advice to you humbly, honorable members, is probably to get energy in yourself to have this conversation with ESCOM on tariffs, for NASA on tariffs, because it's got implications for every generation and the state of financial and fiscal sustainability. There's a need to ensure ESCOM tariffs are fair and not compromised, revenue yields, and that the tariffs are cost-effective. And the cost-effective issue is essentially what NERSA is saying on tariffs and getting the electricity distributed to the endpoint. That's the reflective nature of this. What are the other costs that's built into it to get the energy from ESCOM to the end consumer, whether it's industries or mining and our citizens? We I think it's important that the committee knows that Eskom is on 10 billion rand by municipalities. The size of this debt is also affecting the viability of Eskom and is likely to cripple its operations and long-term plans. Now, there were conversations from municipalities pleading for this debt to be written off. But some of the debt is historic debt. It's old apartheid municipality debt that our democratic municipalities always have to carry. But debt is debt. If you owe it, you must pay it. If anybody feels the appetite to raise it to the Treasury, I say to you, don't even discuss the writing of debt because it's going to take you nowhere. We found one municipality in Free State, Lentzwala Putswa, who's got a budget of close to 2 billion rand a year. I think. But it must repay is from close to 800 million rand, if not more, a year. It's only able to raise 1.1 billion. And even at 1.1 billion budget of the municipality is a deficit budget. So you take on payback. And I don't know whether Parliament will allow me to say it, but the stupidity that happens in some of the municipalities is that they sign loan agreements with Eskom, knowing that they can't pay those loans back, knowing they can't pay those debts to Eskom. They sign loan agreements so that Eskom doesn't switch off or trip the switch for them not to get electricity. So we're quite in a difficult position here at Shepherdson. We think that the special appropriation is placing the legitimacy on the 23 billion rand budget in 2019 appropriation bill, and fiscal prudence is a complicated matter here. The bill represents an additional support to government guarantees to Eskom and consequently mounting government debt and the need for Parliament to continue to exercise oversight on governance and public finances. I think, from my own understanding of the political economy of the relationship between Parliament on behalf of the people and the executing stuff on behalf of the citizens, is that there's a need to unpack what accountability means. Because the stuff that you have in your own regulatory framework about oversight is so soft. It's extremely soft forms of oversight. It's all that given, you ask questions here and there, you walk away, you're not sure where you're coming or going, or whether you've got the factual information to be able to offer to do. So I think there's a need to look at what informs that oversight and that accountability? Because oversight is just an action of accountability. I think I'm going to skip the last point because we've been talking about it over and over. We welcome the unbundling of Eskom. Cautiously, because we need to know what's in there. And maybe part of our job is we can't tell what government policies ought to be. We need to look at government policies and even interpretation to it. And then we tell Parliament or committees like yourself where we think they are issues to be concerned. We are concerned about the leadership instability. And a clear strategy in plan. The Commission underscores the point that financial challenges are only a fraction of Eskom's problems. It's only a fraction. The situation that Eskom Bible says about this. I don't know whether it's true or false, but it's probably a speculative point. If the biggest state-owned company gets away with certain things, why can't the others also get away with that, with the same or more than that? So whatever you do to Eskom, my view is a little more generous and not shared with my commissioners, is that whatever you do around Eskom will set the trend as to how the others is going to behave. And I think it's probably going to be a festival of creating policy and accountability and certainty. If you get a chance to look at that sheet that I was talking about, it's about all the contingent government guarantees and contingent life, the loans and net loans and contingent liabilities to see the total picture. And I bet you when you've seen that picture, and when you've dealt with the Eskom matters on the scissor for a picture, I bet you you're going to say, oops, we need to call in the others. Because Gauteng, in terms of its public statement, Gauteng government, this is a public statement, are not supportive, also creates uncertainty in terms of the revenue generation capabilities of Sunrail to pay back that it's made to actually to upgrade the roads of Gauteng. So we think that that's probably the thing that you can have. Chances lastly, I thought that what needs to happen further, which is not in the slides, is that there's a need to look at the regulatory framework going forward of conditional grants. Sorry, I'm already thinking next week's meeting. So let me come back to this meeting. A regulatory framework that puts part of regulatory procedures, there's a need to think about when are we going to put a ceiling on the overall exposure of government guarantees to the sovereign. Surely somebody must be thinking about that. Then, who can approve government guarantees? I just came from India, spending time with the Indians, looking at financial fiscal matters and government guarantees and everything that sits with it. And I thought I'm going to find some good lessons from them. I'm not so sure whether it be better or whether it be worse or whatever, but the Indian system is that all state-owned companies can qualify for a government guarantee. And when I ask them about the criteria, the standard of measure, determine whether you get or approval or not, they were falling. Basically saying they don't have a framework. But their reserve bank, the central bank, sits in the middle of providing a guarantee. And the problem with their system is that states or provinces in our instance can also state owned companies at that level and provincial governments can also get government guarantees, and our system is quite different. But the point is that we need to think about who can approve guarantees specifically, and how do we do that? What are the disclosure requirements? Because the China Bank issue and others, we don't know what's going on in there. And the specific general terms for extending. Then there's also the development of institutional frameworks that can be considered. A policy framework, how do we integrate guarantees with the budget so we can actually see it open and transparent. We need to develop the capacity jury will end guarantees. Just look at exactly what does the exposure mean, what are the risks to all of us. And there's a need to establish an adequate possibility mechanism for meeting criminals these obligations. Moreover, rather in addition, we I think what needs to happen is that we need to strengthen the link between the government, if there's a government. In fact, I can't even make this point because we I've been told that there's no government guarantees framework, and they're all tied up. But the point is that there's a need to centralize the recording and monitoring of data on government guarantees, ensuring this disclosures. Chairperson, honorable members, whilst we agree and suggest to you consider approval of this appropriation. We think that you need to consider the risk issues that we have raised, the legislative and policy interventions that need to be made, the administrative questions that we are raising, but also the looking at the payment capabilities on this. Thank you, Chairperson, on the moment.
Thank you so much, Prof. But before I open to honourable members to engage with the presentation, I'm going to a conclusion.
Narrative.
Let's just correct the percentage there. There is no way 23 to 26 can be 113%. Deviation is 113 minus 100 is about 30%. So I think it's about 30% deviation. And then the other one, just percentage, I think there's a typographical error again. There's the 43% deviation, rather than 43 minus. On page 11, conclusion. Am I right?
Yes, Michael, it's difficult to deal with the chairperson, just for economists, eh? You're right, Jefferson. Thank you for that.
Let's just correct that, Tanya. Then can we engage with the presentation? You know how good you are, honorable members, straight to the point, so that we can have more questions and allow the professor and his team more time to engage with us. And that will also allow us to ask more questions. So the floor is yours. Thank you. In that number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. So you got your numbers. Okay.
Number 8.
We are number 8. Honourable place. Let's go.
Thanks, Chair. I also try to be economic on time. Prof, let's welcome this presentation, thought provoking. But Chair, I have just picked up on a few things. Chair, Prof said in 5.2 of the narrative, I think the second sentence, that set of challenges warrant a multi-pronged intervention strategy. It's a healing process.
Or the healing period.
If the Prof can, I know, Kawazu for some account, but if you can just give us an estimated realistic time frame. There's a lot of 5-year period talk of this healing period. Is it realistic? If yes, is that 5-year period really, really about to take us out of the mud where we are now?
where would us be, say, in that 5-year period?
So the second one would be, I'm looking at the level at which government is put by the rating agencies, Prof.
My worry, you also raised this question of the monitor, IMF. But it looks like you, the academics, view this thing differently. Some are saying, Ahmad, there's nothing wrong, cool down. And some of you are saying, the monitor is at the gate.
I'm also taking this in line with your 3.11 of the narrative on credit rating. How is Eskom rated by major rating agencies? And to what extent does the current credit rating contribute to Eskom's inability to raise on time in capital? And I just checked on the future,
on the condition that you are going forward for the bailout.
I have not yet got to the extent of actually saying that what we have or don't have to approve this special appropriation. I'm not yet there. But
FFC is putting a proposal
which, as you conclude, Prof. says, yes, you may, but consider.
But then, how are these proposed conditions different from the ones which were put in place by the National Treasury in the past?
I don't want to delve, Prof, into questioning as to whether such conditions worked or did not work for us. That is not what I'm thinking. But I'm just checking
with you as to how different, what is new. The last one would be, on my side, the wage bill versus job security. In respect of the proposals on managing Eskom's staff complements in whatever we're doing, how can this be achieved without tampering with the labor relations and also the potential to job losses? Let's check.
Thank you very much, Chair. Well, let me begin by also welcoming the presentation. I think it's very comprehensive. But I just have a few questions to pose. The first one is the general narrative that we find currently being spoken to, which is the one of policy uncertainty. I just want to find out if whether have the FFC picked up any specific areas of policy uncertainty. And if so, do you think that the President and the Cabinet are doing enough in order to tighten that particular gap, if there's any that you have identified, so that you are able to advise us in terms of our work in Parliament? The second one, Chair, is that the FFC is recommending a quarterly reporting process on the progress that is being made. Now, if you come to Parliament, you would have realized that SCOPA would have done an inspection in your court in one of the or two of the power stations that ESCOM is visiting. The Department of Energy will also interact with ESCOM. We do as well. How would the FFC advise that we synergize our work in a manner that we are able to get to one common outcome? because we are running a risk that if the other portfolio committees are doing their own way, we might find that the outcome does not speak to the intended result by various committees. The third one, Chair, is on the government debt to GDP ratio. Has the FFC commissioned any study to compare South Africa's position to the similar economy across the world? And if so, what is the average global ratio? Because my own little desktop research have indicated that there are other countries of similar economic standing which are very well, and some developed countries which are almost at 100%. No. The question that comes to me is, why would it then be an issue when South Africa is facing a similar situation? And these rating agencies keeps on speaking to this thing of the government debt to GDP ratio. But we're asking other economies similar to us, they are being rated highly as compared to us. So I just wanted to find that if whether we have done any study to the debate. Now, Chair, the other one is on the issue of the measures that you are recommending on the acceleration of outsourcing. I just want clarity. In terms of your recommendation, are you recommending that we relocate management and operations, or are you recommending a complete sell-off? Because if you look at the restructuring, it will have different meaning to different people, depending where you are sitting and what is prevailing at that particular time. In the event that you are recommending selling off, do we think that if you sell off, can the cash reserves be used to assist the labor force in ESCOM in order to be reskilled, retrained, so that they are employable elsewhere? Because I think the biggest headache that we have in the restructuring process is how will it contribute to the current unemployment challenges that the country is facing. And I think it will be important that we are clear when you are saying this outsourcing, are we selling or are we just relocating the running and the management? Chair, the last one is on the inefficiencies that the FFC is picking up. There's just but one reality that is missing, the issue of corruption. We are not speaking directly to it, and then for me it's worrisome, because we are discussing a special appropriation of over 50 billion. How much of that allocation will end up being spent irregularly? And my concern is that if we keep on bailing ESCOM out and some of this money is being used irregularly, what are we saying about those companies that are providing services and products to ESCOM? Because when I looked at some of the company statements, they speak of 1.3 billion that has been lost that they were able to pick up. And that is in the period that they've been bailing ESCOM out. So I think for me it's important that we look at the current operation of ESCOM, and maybe it can be one of the conditions that where there was irregular expenditure, there must be significant improvement on the irregular spending for us to continue bailing out. Because if we continue bailing out with poor management, poor leadership, and rampant corruption, it's as if we're putting water in a leaky bucket and we expect to fill it up. It will not happen. So I just wanted to check if whether have we looked at that and the impact that it has. The very last one. What is the view of the FFC on the role of the acting CEO and being in the board as well? Do we think that there is a problem, or do we think that it's something that will strengthen the work of ESCOM going forward? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that presentation. Although I must admit that whatever you told us, we already know. It sounds like that we are really in a crisis, but I want to be very direct about that. With all the information that you have provided us and with the crisis at ESCOM, can you tell us, honestly and openly, do you really see any hope with all the bailouts that we are giving? Can you really see a turnaround strategy which is going to work 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years from today? Be very direct about this and give us that response. You know, the issue of these municipalities, particularly that we're talking about, a very great percentage of those debts seems to have been from the apartheid era. Now, I think it's a feeble excuse, particularly for us, confused in my view, because I think you need to, if you can give us some figures as to what percentage of that debt is old debt, that will give us an idea, because, I mean, you're talking about 10 billion a year, while we are giving you hundreds of billions of rent, so really, I think it's my idea, not debt. I think it's inefficiency. Generally on part of ESCOM. Now, it is clear, there's no doubt about it, up to today, that there is really no sound plan in place to turn ESCOM around. And I think we all must admit that. Where do you believe we are going wrong? Where do you think who should be playing that more pivotal role in trying to make sure that when we are appropriating this money, you know, it's very easy to appropriate money when it's not yours. But here we are appropriating money again, money, but we cannot see the return. So whose responsibility? Because particularly, if you take this committee, which is supposed to be an oversight committee following the budget, with all the red tape that exists, this committee is like helpless. It just doesn't have the mandate to do anything, to be very honest with you. And that's the experience we have found over a period of time. You know, I don't want to go into anything that is not really here, but I was so frustrated this weekend. So frustrated that despite bringing this out in Parliament about 20 times over, how I find a particular municipality in KZN, a contract worth R500,000 goes out for two million rand, because you're putting three and four middlemen, they all are making money, coming back to what you were saying, not getting value for money. So it seems to be across the board, and we are losing over 200 billion rand a year as a result of that. We're not willing to do anything about it, despite addressing it time and time again. So, there's so much of red tape, you don't know how to address the issue. We know the faults, we know where the problems are, but our hands are tied. We don't know what to do, to be very honest with you. So maybe you should just tell us, you know, you say that the assets are declining. Do you foresee a crisis at some stage because if the assets continue to decline and your liabilities are reduced, so you're going to reach what you call a fiscal cliff, or you're going to be technically insolvent at some stage to come? Now, we talk about the infrastructure maintenance, and I must agree with you that if you take money that you did not budget for and you spend it elsewhere, somewhere else you have to suffer. You understand? And infrastructure seems to be a problem for the last 50 years, and not only in ESCOM. Every government department has not been providing for it. If you know that the lifespan of these power stations are 30 years and 40 years, when you built one, now you're supposed to be planning 30 years in advance. So again, you know, it would appear that it is, you can give ESCOM all the money in the world. I want you to tell me if I'm correct. It's not going to solve the problem unless you deal with the ESCOM problem holistically with all the challenges relevant to it. That's what I'd like to know. Now, there's a very large percentage of theft of electricity in South Africa, illegal connections and things. Very little or nothing seems to happen about it. You know, I don't know what, you know, how you can quantify it, but there is no doubt about it. Somebody is going to be paying for it some way. Again, it's for me a poor management when it comes to that. Now, I want you to tell me, on the one hand, we want to make ESCOM profitable. We want to make sure that they generate enough electricity, because that, in effect, if we want economic growth on the one hand, that economic growth depends on the supply of that energy. So how is economic growth going to be achieved in South Africa if we're going to have the crisis? Because, you know, if you listen to what the Minister of Trade and Industry is saying, he wants to enhance the manufacturing industry and a whole lot of it, which is very good because we want to make growth. But I want you to tell me, how is that going to be successful
given the fact that we got a crisis because we're not going to have enough energy to be able to provide it. And last feature, I wouldn't go any further, is my understanding is we're also selling energy to outside the borders. Am I correct? I think that's my understanding. Yes, we are. Now, we don't have enough energy. We're having a crisis here in terms of energy, and we are now selling energy outside. If you could just tell me the logic behind that, because I believe that if you want economic growth, you've got to make sure you have the power. You're selling the power there, which is helping other countries to develop and react to the crisis. So let me stop there for now.
Just in terms of the conditions, which was a large part of this presentation, I think the most important, the first thing I want to know is, have you received National Treasury's draft conditions, the FFC's that? And if not, do you think they were adequate? We were told of them last week, and some of them just seemed like routine managerial tasks, like publish a turnaround strategy, daily reporting of liquidity status and cash flow, a board must approve a schedule of redemptions and interest payments. How does an entity manage its debt when it doesn't have an existing schedule of redemptions and interest payments, I wonder? I mean, surely these things exist in some system, or is Eskom just scared? Suddenly says, oh, you owe us money, please pay up, like a mafia-style system. What is going on if it doesn't have this? It's quite troubling. Monthly management reports we signed up for the group CEO and group CFO prove that Eskom is tax compliant. I mean, you know, these are some routine managerial tasks. There shouldn't be conditions. So I want to know if you think that these conditions in National Treasury are sufficient, firstly. Secondly, I want to get your opinion, maybe opinions aren't the right word, but I do would like to get your opinion. Do you think that conditions should be outsourced to the minister by Parliament? Or do you think Parliament having a power of the purse explicitly designed for in our constitution means that Parliament itself, and therefore this committee being the committee dealing with appropriations, should actually be designing and imposing conditions on special appropriations in every single appropriations bill? It just says the minister may impose conditions for transfer. Well, surely, if the power of the purse sits with Parliament, and if our constitutional design is such that budgetary matters sit with Parliament, and we approve and say yes or no, if we approve, we should be approving with conditions. And if so, do you think it would be appropriate for this committee to then maybe look at conditions if the various legislative drafters and the many people who sit in Parliament providing support, the legal team and so on, were to come up with sensible ones, do you think that it's appropriate for this committee to be imposing those conditions rather than waiting for National Treasury to ask Eskom just to do its routine managerial work? Thanks.
Honourable comment.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation by the FFC. But, Chairperson, I think we need to just start by not looking over this thing of the management and the responsibility of Eskom. Because it is really a call for concern, because it seems that there would not be accountability. We would find one person occupying those positions. It's really not correct. And, Chairperson, I'm just worried by all the presentation that was referring to the 10 million rand owed by the municipalities. Hence, we have been debating that with the Treasury, but it is always coming here and there, but there is no straightforward answer or a proposal to say how can we deal with that. And we'd be having that for the next 10 years. As usual, it is stated that it has been there since the apartheid era. I think this must be dealt with. And the worrisome part of it is that the DD for Treasury said he being equal to the principals at the other departments, it becomes very difficult for him to can impose on them. So I don't know where is that going to take us to. But at the same time, I would just want maybe the FFC, if they can maybe indicate to us, because the unemployment rate is at 27.6%. We are speaking. But I would just want to know maybe as to what extent will this proposed bill help in the prevention of the job losses. And in respect of the proposal regarding the establishment of an ad hoc committee, which we look at the use of the financial support that is given by the government, how would this committee then complement the work that is already been done by the other appropriation committees and portfolio committees on public enterprise? And Chairperson, I just want to check which committee among all of these will specifically be responsible for the monitoring of the of ESCOM, or maybe like on a quarterly basis, anything like proposed here. I think I need more than just to check.
Honorable
Chairman.
Thank you, Chairperson. we all know, and it's like Honorable Sheikh Imam has said, the professor has said things, and some of these things we know already. We all know that ESCOM has played, or was sort of a theater of where corruption has played its ugly head out. And it was always used, and it has been used to sort of capture the state. And I want to hear the Prof's, maybe his opinion on it. I don't know how much weight does his opinion carry, how much steel does his opinion carry, as to don't he suddenly think that for government the slow or the dragging of their feet to sort of get the management structure right of ESCOM is a deliberate function to sort of wanting to privatize some competence of ESCOM. Because we need to get, we have seen, you have reported, there's two countries, you don't have a CEO, or you know the component of the management structure is not right of ESCOM, and maybe that's why we are having this inconsistency. Doesn't he think it plays maybe perhaps some role in wanting to outsource or privatize some of the competence of ESCOM? Then secondly, Chair, the reprioritization of the budget, doesn't FFC have maybe done some research? Shouldn't we just scratch some of the government entities that is currently having? Why we always point out to service delivery, and it's always the poor that have to suffer. But we are having entities that are so useless and are doing nothing, and they're just taking from the fiscus. But every time we are coming here and something has to be, money has to be given to a key entity that serves the poor, it's at the cost of the poor. But we are having entities that are just there and simply not serving their purpose. Have they done work regarding to that? And like for us as EFF, and it's known that the way of wanting to privatize ESCOM is just the deepest level again of white minority capital, because we know that it will be the white minorities that will go and buy shares of ESCOM, and it will be the white minorities that will tell government how to give services of water and electricity. We all know that, because if you look at how many black South Africans does really have capital to buy components in ESCOM, it's very few. And they won't be given a fair chance to buy shares or buy a components in ESCOM. We already know, or can tell you now, it will be the white minorities that will govern ESCOM.
Thank you, Chair. By just reading one slide together with the narrative document here, you can see the state of ESCOM. Where, for example, Prof said in the presentation that in 2014, 2015, right, ESCOM moved from from a profit of 9.3 billion rands to a loss of 20.7 billion rands in 2019. Right, and then during that same period, revenue grew by 80.3% in 2014-2015, only for it to grow by less than a quarter of a percent in 2017-2018, which tells you exactly the extent of decline and the looting that took place at Eskom during that period, because there was no focus really on trying to do proper cost management and to try and grow the business. But the issue here, Prof, which I want to ask, without committing myself, because we must still deliver it whether we agree on this government guarantee issue in tenor, on this special appropriation. Is the issue here not about, you mentioned a very critical point about soft accountability approach by Parliament to entities where we, at times, we stop short of blowing kisses at entities when they sit in front of us instead of asking tough questions. But in many instances, what also happens is that even in the few instances where we ask them questions, not for political posturing, but to get them to answer questions properly and to implement the necessary remedial actions, what we do is there are no consequences in any cases where people don't implement. Look, I was looking at some, because I also happen to serve one of the committees of public enterprise. Most of the issues which continue to be flagged on a daily basis are some of the issues we raised as far back as 2014, and but there's been very little wrong implementation. Because what you discover is that even if some of these entities had implemented 40% of some of the issues that Parliament recommended, the situation would not be as dire as it is today. But I think the approach needs to be different, Prof. Rather than, let's say, instead of just focusing on your normal run-of-the-mill form of accountability mechanism that uses Parliament, we're in a crisis situation here. There should be a dedicated focus by Parliament on this issue of managing the government guarantees, but not look at them in a piecemeal fashion. Because you see, these entities are located all over the show. This committee doesn't know, for example, when SAA is going to hit trouble until it's in the media, right? And then people have to react and call people in front of the committee to come and appear. Maybe what we should start doing, Prof, is to conduct an inventory, an assessment of all the government guarantees that have been given to SOEs. Look at the state, right, to a proper and assessment of risks. But we also have a framework and a criteria that we as Parliament can use in trying firstly to evaluate the proposals for guarantees that come before government, and to also be able to be in a position to do our own assessment, which is independent of the reports that are produced by National Treasury and the Executive, right? Our own assessment of the risks which are associated with those issues. I worry, Prof, because the last time I checked, I thought maybe I read or studied from economic theory, but contingency reserves are also supposed to help us when there's a, to cover claims on guarantees, but we keep on throwing down contingency reserves while we create our government guarantees. And be creating more risk for the country. The other issue is that when you grow your government guarantees book, shouldn't you get to a point where you develop a government guarantee reserve fund? I know we don't have money, but consider it in future as a risk mitigating measure going forward. To say, we can't keep on issuing out guarantees left, right, and center to entities that are going to pose risks on the fiscus without taking steps to try and mitigate that risk in some other form. I think it's a bit reckless for us to do it that way. But up until we stop managing or looking at these guarantees in a peaceful fashion, even if this committee, I think we have the power and the capacity to do so, if we can be capacitated by Parliament, probably to be able to evaluate them, look at the entire picture, what are the issues, and then what would be the appropriate or most appropriate accountability mechanisms. The previous speaker is right. What is written as conditions for those guarantees is really like, for example, if you're to sit here, you're praising a fish for swimming. That's what those people are supposed to do on a daily basis, and yet we put those things into conditions. We're playing marbles. Thank you.
Honorable teachers.
Thank you, Chairperson, and once more,
my apologies for late arrival and not having benefited also from the opening remarks of the chair, but also the presentation by the person. But where I participated, I really appreciate the input. I think, Chairperson, mine is just going to be on 6.5 of the narrative, on page 12, where the FSC says there is also a need to ensure that the electricity generation space is open for more independent power producers. I end there, Chairperson. I just want to find out from the FSC on on your own view, what is your views with regard to independent power producers versus building the generation capacity of ESCOM and ensuring that competent, qualified, and whatever type of people are in place to make sure that there is generation capacity is strengthened, and also the point that you made about issue of maintenance of the infrastructure that it can be enhanced. I am raising this because I'm sitting here asking myself whether the FSC has ever considered the cost of IPPs to ESCOM. Right now we're informed that ESCOM buys electricity for 100 cents, which is 100 cents, and sells it for 90 cents. And when it comes to the renewable energy component, they buy it for about 5 rands and sell it for 3 rands. And if you are an investor in the renewable energy space all over the world, you will definitely pack up and go to South Africa, because that is where you are going to make a killing. So it is important that we get to look at this, because it doesn't make sense. I'm just sitting here thinking that if Makumalo has got to bake fat cakes in the township, and the cost of baking the fat cakes comes to 2 rand, and she goes and sells them for 1 rand, it means that she's doing charity work. So in essence, ESCOM is not doing business with IPPs. They are running a charitable, indirect taxpayer subsidies to independent power producers. So it would be important, Chairperson, that when ESCOM comes before the committee, they also present to us the model that they have in place for IPP. Because for me, this is not sustainable for ESCOM, because every now and then, like we've been informed by National Treasury and now by FSC, that this is not the last, it's not the first, but not the last time ESCOM will be coming here with cap in hand. The other thing that I would want to know from the FSC, in your view, wouldn't it be better for ESCOM or for the transmission and distribution component in ESCOM to be the level at which that the engagement with IPPs then happens? Because then there would be an arrangement, like a wheeling arrangement, where the generated power from whoever could be wheeled through the transmission of ESCOM and the distribution network of the municipalities and ESCOM for a particular fee, or for an offset with power that would then be equitable to what has been wheeled through, then the arrangement would be directly between private. If it is the intensive energy users group like the mining houses, they could then buy directly from an IPP, get it wheeled through this infrastructure of ESCOM, and get up until the stage they probably would then have the ability of different role players being able to directly transmit their power, if that is going to end up being. But for now, we would advance an argument that says it can be done through ESCOM. With regard to municipal debt, is the FSC able to engage Southern Copper and National Treasury with regard to this matter?
or have you been able to, in the past, to do that? Because it would be interesting for me to understand whether the municipalities equally understand the role of ESCOM in the economy, but also the role of ESCOM in their own sustainable local economic development trajectory that they are involved in. So it would be important. National Treasury would come in because of primarily maybe the ability to engage in terms of the financial side, but the oversight responsibility that COCTA has equally a role to play. The other thing, Chairperson, that is a bit worrying, whenever there is a talk of debt to ESCOM, be it from National Treasury or from even the FSC, we talk about municipalities, but what about these big service providers of ESCOM, who actually cash in from ESCOM but equally owe ESCOM? It would be important that we also understand that there are service providers that owe ESCOM, and that we need, as this committee, to emphasize, Chairperson, that at the time that ESCOM comes here, they come with that book to us, to show us how they are able to collect their debts from their, even those who owe them historically. Yes, we have been informed about the historical debt even before apartheid of municipalities. But we don't know what the private sector is. And it is important that we get to know, because we know that there are many companies that are owing ESCOM, even those who are suppliers of coal and other primary energy sources. And we would want to know from ESCOM exactly how they are dealing with their debt book. Thank you, Chairperson.
Kaiso.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me take the cue of welcoming the new content advisor who joined us this morning and the presentation made by Professor. My interest was exactly what my honorable comrade Dipuo Peters has said around the issue of the role of private sector in this debate of ESCOM. And the professor raised something that attracted my mind immediately when he said, usually the 30 billion rand that is being owed by that municipality to ESCOM. At the same time, the professor says, no, there is a historical context behind the whole issue of ESCOM. Now, my immediate question would be, Chairperson, is usually Puswa not part of the, or is separate from this historical issue on ESCOM? So if usually Puswa is a separate, it is separate from that history, then it's something else. Because I can tell you something very different about Mangaung Metro, for instance. If you can learn about Mangaung Metro, you learn a very different story from what you're talking about in Israeli culture. Because the private sector, actually, the monopoly companies have found one thing in all these issues that we are referring to now, that they have played their role as far as drowning ESCOM, as far as bidding is concerned as well. So it's not usually Puswa only. Unless there's a proof that now it's only usually Puswa, which was not history in terms of apartheid. Secondly, I want to get from the professor that are we dealing with privatization? Is what are you saying on the slide here? Is it privatization or partial privatization? Because my understanding is that outsourcing is one way of privatization. But what is it actually that is being recommended here from the slide? When you talk about regulatory framework, where a number of players will be allowed. Are you referring to privatization or semi-privatization or outsourcing, which I believe might be having the same understanding? Let me quickly jump on to the issue of politics as well around the issue of the school. I don't think we'll go to a situation where we'll surrender our responsibility when it comes to ESCOM. ESCOM has drawn a number of forces in itself as an entity, both international and domestic interests. That one we cannot exclude when we're discussing about it. Hence the pressure that now these agents, rating agents, have interest. It's not just an innocent thing that they would use ESCOM as a measuring barometer for their investments. So we may not be pushed to that extent, but otherwise we don't have any option but to be accepting that we have only to pass this special appropriation bill to deal with the issue and deal with other consequences that led to the situation after that. But then we need to bear in mind that the multilateral organization do have interest in ESCOM. We must not rule out that their interest is also aimed at, you know, enforcing that we end up allowing a situation where the borrowing is going to be done from these multilateral structures. So it's one area that I wanted to ask for you to get clarity on those two areas. Thank you very much.
Well done. Just before I allow the professor to come in, a few comments from my side. When ESCOM is coming here next week, I think what you need to do, Darren, is to summarize these things which the honorable member said they must be covered by them so that they don't come here and tell us big stories which are not going to talk to the things that we want to hear. So if you could summarize these things that amongst others, these are the issues that we need to be covered. Based on the input from honorable members, I must confess that I've tried to understand the business model of ESCOM. I get lost in the process. I don't understand it. Yeah, no. So they make us understand it. I definitely don't understand it. You know, if you remember sometime just before last year, the way the IDPs were sold, and the private sector in particular was saying about the IDPs, they say one of the reasons why the economy is not growing is because government has not signed into the IDPs. Mm-hmm. They would not continue as to how is that going to happen. But whether it's causality or correlation, what we see is that there is correlation now that was sort of subsidizing the IDPs, and the financial position of ESCOM is deteriorating at the same time. So I think we also need to understand from them that is exactly they must take us through what is the effect of the IDPs on the cash flows and the balance sheet of ESCOM, and then the other issues that have been raised by honorable members. I think Professor is trying to help us and understand what the problems are. Right. having understood those problems, the inputs that we've made, I think we, when ESCOM comes here and to the we have also invited the Minister of Public Enterprises, am I right? Also come here. We need to get the response to these issues which are being raised, which are known and which have been raised before, exactly the issues which are being raised now. How is perhaps the ESCOM board and the executive responding to them? But I think the important, it has been coming in different tunes from us.
I think we need to define for ourselves exactly what do we want to do, right? And see what stops us from doing the things that we want to do as a committee. Okay? We shouldn't create barriers for ourselves even before we start moving. Let's say for us to properly play our oversight function on this matter, right? These are the things that we need to do. And then try and see whether there's anything stops us from doing those things and to start doing them. Otherwise, we'll always be coming here to deal with these types of things when we must deal with the bailouts and so on, but the other leg of our responsibilities not being able to execute. So I think we need to raise it around the table amongst ourselves as the committee and say, these are the things that will come to us. What is our responsibility, legal and otherwise, and what do we want to do? And we put those things for ourselves and say, these are the things that we want to do, and see whether there's anything which stops us. So I just wanted to say that while the prof can also help with other things, but you must know that the bus stops with us. The bus stops with us, you must define exactly what we want to do. having said that, a few things. I think what we've been saying, whether we're meeting Treasury or talking to FFC before and other players, I think what is very clear what we've been saying, that where we are, there is no plan that we're funding. We don't know what we're funding. So that's critical. That can we be taken, what is it that we're funding? You see? Then we can be in a position to critique even the strategy which is being put in front of us. So I think that's there we if we don't do that, I think we'll definitely be shaking on our responsibility, because voters are going to ask us that yes, you have approved this. What is it that we're finding? So I think that's a difficult question. I think we need to push on that one. We raised this issue with Treasure, National Treasure. So much has been said about the CRO who has just been appointed. And it looks like we are putting all the trust, future of ESCOM, that the CRO coming. And I must say, I have my doubts. The person who's going there, it's a financial guru. He has got good record on that and so on. But knowing these types of organizations, it will take you a year, 2 years to understand it. Otherwise, people are there, they'll run circles around you. Yeah. They'll run circles around you and you sit down and you try coming all types of models, financial models. But if you don't know what's happening there, there is an issue. So I think the risk which is there, which I think, again, we must put our heads together and say how we deal with that. It's apart from the CRO, what is there? But one thing that we also can't run away from is that it was mentioned by one of honorable members. The governance thing. I think once you start having the confusion around the governance, the committees, the CRO, how is it going to relate to the CEO and so on, I just see conflict in it before it starts. Yeah. Because if I'm a CEO of this organization and then this person will say, who does he report or who does he report it to, and what are my responsibilities over him, and who accounts to the board, and so on and so forth. And when we come here to Parliament, who's going to take the reins? So I think again, perhaps in the plan, that must come out very clear exactly how are they dealing with that. So I'm just saying, there is a problem around the governance. While the executive is trying to solve a certain problem, they may be creating another problem, which may end up not constraining the very same process that they are trying to deal with. And the plan should be very clear. Whatever has been made, where are we going to prof? Perhaps even from your side on the proposal that where are we going to have these efficiency gains here? Because that's what we're trying to do. Can we be very clear where the efficiency gains are going to come from? And I think that therein again, when ESCOM comes here, I think these are things that we need to know. About theft of electricity, we always when we talk about this general as the public, talk about these people who connect these things. Yeah. And so on. Yeah. But there is so much theft by big business of electricity. Right? So much big. So again, we need to be told about that.
Yeah.
Right? Because that theft is not just because people can't pay. When they steal that electricity, they are even more sophisticated than in your value symbol line.
Right.
So again, big business and so on, and what is Eskom, there is, that's for sure, there's so much debt, that's big amounts of money that we are losing. Evergreen contracts or long-term contracts, the impact of those contracts to Eskom financial viability. We need to, what are the major contracts? They must give us some of the contracts that, because these are the contracts that by the who are funding. As we appropriate here, these are the contracts. We need to know which are those contracts and who are those people and so on and so forth, right? Because as we appropriate this money, we also have got the responsibility of transformation.
Yeah.
Right? Does it deal with the transformation that we are trying to deal with? Honorable Samino, what you were also talking about, that we shouldn't, at all times when we deal with these things, we should also be alive to the question of transformation, dealing with the inequalities that we're having, but again the exclusion of the majority of people of this country from the economy. So we should also be knowing where exactly this money is going to go. So they must tell us that. Lastly, I've been confronted by a number of people here on the grounds of parliament and even outside. They are saying, U.S. Appropriations Committee, you seem to have some companies in this particular one is Eskom, who has been given a breadwinner status, a blue-eyed boy or girl of the Appropriations Committee. Some of the SOEs have been here for more than 2 years trying to get some bailout, and they're not getting it. One of those is SABC, for instance. For the past 2 years, they've been trying to get about a 3.2 billion rand, and it has not been appropriated. And it has been insisted that they must come with a plan. That's what they are saying to me. We come with all types of plans, but others you give them money, not 3.2 billion, billions and billions of money without a plan. How does it work? So I think it talks to what has been proposed here, that we need to have our own criteria to where do we start even considering the bailouts that we are talking about. And I think the support staff must also help us with that. And other members, I think the challenge should be on us. I think this thing that we are thinking, let's not think that somebody else will do it, will do that. Let's say one of these things done and see perhaps what type of a resource we need to try and do those things. Because you may run the risk of, for instance, honorable subject of saying, can we get the conditions that you have been given? And then what comes back to us is something that is not satisfying us. So I'm just saying that we need to identify those things ourselves. Prof, it's your turn. You respond what you can respond to, what you want to bring back to us as the committee, please do that. But you know that professors, they've got minds of solving very difficult problems, so that's why we're throwing every problem on your table.
Thank you, Chairperson. You don't take health breaks, eh? I couldn't leave because I had to hear music. I said, can I excuse you 1 minute, please?
Yeah.
Okay, let's think about 3 minutes.
Some of us are over 40, you know?
Thank you, okay. So you just...
This one will be some of the others will just to come back to you. But let me put...
And you've got about 3 minutes?
I'm not so sure whether I'm going to cover everything, so it will be far less than that. But let's work on the 20% from 20 out of the 30. See, I just wanted to say that overall, we're just helping to paint the canvas of the... I'm so happy, Honorable... shaky moments also saying I was worried about this comment, but the issue is that we're helping to paint the canvas, because part of our responsibility is not to make the job easy for you.
Yeah.
Because you can't be representing 45 million people and you want to have an easy job. This is complicated. It is deep, it is historic, it is present, and it's almost like a clear and present danger to the Huskers. But it's also one of those things that you have to intervene into. So the comment that I would make, and I wanted to say to Honorable Sarupeng that I used to be an advisor to Minister Sulu, and she always used to say, I don't want your opinion, I want your advice. You know? And we always get confused with the difference between opinion and advice, and the Honorable Chairperson will know that if you sit in that ministry and you sometimes say, what is your advice, and sometimes you say, so what is your opinion? So my job is not to give you my opinion. My job is to give you my advice. Because if you want my opinion, you're not going to fulfill your responsibility in terms of this job. See, the other thing I thought that important to say is that some of the things you'll hear tomorrow and the year after that again. Like Sigmund Freud, the issue is conditioning. You need to hear the story, even if you think you know it. What we're putting forward to you is to reconfirm what you understand is the problem, but you're also saying to you, here are the possible solutions to it. So part of the idea then is to talk you through it. I'm going to just cherry pick the ones that I think it's important from each honorable member, and I'm going to do the number thing like you did. Sorry, this is probably the old home affairs, but you have a number now in my response. The period of a prolonged intervention strategy be raised by Honorable Mfrozela Zama is that you have to determine it cannot be prolonged because the special appropriation is 2 years. So to have the legality of it in place, you have to put conditions that probably my advice would be that you can either do it 2x2, which is in the term of this parliament, which means it gives you 4 years. Or you can do after the appropriation and then keep the conditions in place beyond the appropriation. The problem with Parliament is that when you rise for election, then you forget about the decisions that was taken in the previous Parliaments because of the lack of consistency in things. So I would say that you need to look at what is the time frame of this appropriation saying. And it's a 2-year appropriation, and the things that we're suggesting to you, you could probably ask. You can ask them to submit these things in the next 6 months as a condition. Because to have your special appropriation in a way is also helping to create conditionalities on the institution. Previous government guarantees, I think the point that we would make is that, and it's actually, I don't know whether your content advisor is coming in the right time. If I'm him, I would probably run away now, because I heard this is his first meeting. But the performance of previous conditional grants to two of the honorable members is critical, because the reason why I raised those conditions was soft. If those conditions were hard, you would have heard firstly how did those previous special appropriations performed, and what was the condition set levels for the special appropriations. And the reason why we're raising certain things is that we're saying you need to consider these in addition to what's already on the table. So I cannot say to you whether we agree or disagree with the Treasury or the Minister of Finance. That's not our job. You need to look at our presentation and see the subtext of our presentation, what we are saying to you, and then find a way of reconciling it. on the wage thing, I think there are a couple of this noises and distractions around it. On the wage bill versus job security, you cannot deal with that without dealing with the Labor Relations Act. You're going to deal with the restructuring and all the three R's of what comes normally with that, with restructuring, redeployment, retrenchment, right-sizing, etc., all the R's. If you don't deal with it in terms of the Labor Relations Act, the ESCOM Establishment Act, the PFMA, and a range of other things, then whoever does it will be in contravention of our constitutional law. And that's probably a question that needs to be posed to them, especially as it relates to the idea of separation, unbundling of the three constituent components of ESCOM as articulated in previous. Honorable Tour is the issue of policy uncertainty. Just that the conversation that you're having is a indicative of policy uncertainty in the uncertain environment that you're in. Where do you take ESCOM? How does ESCOM relate to other an important sphere of government's constitutional responsibility, municipalities in particular? How does it relate to the policies of legislation of government? Let me just fast track to say, I want to read that point of a big legislation that this committee sees with Honorable Chairperson. The Money Bill Amendment Procedures and Related Matters Act is your act. You're empowered to act according to that act. So what does it mean? That you can put those conditions. You can say, we disagree with these conditions, we want these conditions in. I don't know, South Africa is quite a different place every day when you get up. It's as part of the conviction of your political, social conscious thought about the responsibility of this institution relative to its citizens. So you can put any conditions on. As long as it's fair, as long as it's rational, as long as it's justifiable, as long as it's prudent, as long as it's going to indicate the high level of return on this particular investment. The only point that we're making is the carry-through effect of the other appropriations relative to this one. Now, I'm not so sure, but those who were operational in this committee can tell you before whether my simple view is that the appropriation committee on special appropriation didn't follow through on the conditions. But those conditions were probably so administrative that it doesn't help you to turn this thing around. And hence the issue about reporting process is that the last time I spoke about Parliament and to Parliament, one member of Parliament reported me to Honorable Butzolos, and I was in trouble. So I don't want to tell Parliament what to do. But my advice would be in sitting in this position, it actually doesn't matter whether you're in conflict with other committees, or whether you do a slut mandate screen, whether what SCOPA will do what SCOPA needs to do, the Energy Committee will do what the Energy Committee needs to do. I'm saying that in terms of the special appropriation, you can't approve something and not follow through on it. It's your bill. You're going to table it. You need to track the performance of this bill. You need to check whether the mechanisms are in place to monitor, and based on what you've agreed and based on what you put in your motion in Parliament on this thing. Because there's going to be attacks from different angles on it in any case. The different political parties, including the majority parties, will have a negative view on some of the things that have been said. That's why it's so critical that the collective agree to the minimum.
Honorable Tehani, just shows that it's getting hotter.
But you need to agree on the, I mean, in the past we had this thing about sufficient consensus. You know, I don't know whether sufficient consensus is going to work in this one, it's going to be the holy grail of opening up the space to make sure things happen. The issue is here, the citizens want this forum to be able to make sure that we got the conditions in place that creates rigidities for not allowing of the next request on a government guarantee. But we create flexibility in terms of the performance of this institution so that it yields the return. So I'm saying that you are responsible as an honorable team called Standing Committee on Appropriations to do exactly what the law requires, that law which is called the Money Belt Amendment Procedures and Credit Matters Act. It's your job. And you can change those conditions. I mean, that's the authority that you have. But I said it the last time, when we all sit together in these committees, I don't know what happens on your way to. You all opinion on your way to. The plenary things changes. That's what we see on TV rather. You know, look at that one.
I'd like a point of clarity there. Whilst I agree that we would be able to make the necessary amendments that demand what we have, but I'd like you to give it to us on the basis that we are in a no-win situation. If you don't give it, we've got a crisis, and you give it, we've got a crisis. So how do we approach it from that angle?
The approach is simple. You have to, I did say in the beginning, we recommend that there needs to be appropriation. A special appropriation. You need to consider approving the special appropriation. That's what we're saying. We're not disputing it. What we are saying, however, is that you need to consider the improving on the conditionalities for the appropriation. That's a significant and substantive difference here. So if you take the conditionalities as it is, then you're going to probably kind of get it the way you're getting it. But if you're saying that your approval, consideration, approval of the special approvals is on condition that these following things get built in, then I think you're on the right track. I mean, we've made certain suggestions to you. And one of the big thing that the chairperson also just raised in the last comment is you can insist that within the next 6 months, for example, I mean 6 months is fair, you know, 3 months or whatever, that a plan on the conditional specification on the special appropriation be provided to you, a foolproof plan on deliverables, on benefits, on risks, financial and otherwise, on organizational changes, on time frames, on new proposals on legislation for this, and the issues around sealing and that. You can insist on that. And we think that you should consider that. On the outsourcing, I think the point is that only point of view we're making, you see, ESCOM is a multi-variate, ESCOM is another animal. It is huge. So it's hard to see, for outsiders to see exactly what's going on inside ESCOM. I mean, my own experience, even the president struggled to see what's inside ESCOM. And the reason is, in my previous life, which I didn't understand, is that the ESCOM people said that they can't release certain information because of the potential risk to their competitive edge. Because competition always comes into market competition. We can't give information around the contracting, the negotiations, the financial issues to it, debt repayment conditions, etc., etc. And I said, so why don't
but,
you...
But who are they competing with being a monopoly?
You know, they are... I'd like you to say, okay, I don't understand. How can a monopoly compete with itself? But the thing is you need to open, strip this thing down in terms of what is happening inside this institution. And it's on the non-core and the core, and that's why it's difficult to say to you. Because we don't know the interconnections between the core and non-core. The engineering side, the manufacturing, the generation side, etc., etc. So it's hard to do these things. And even hard, honorable member, to be able to tell you whether this the selling of assets would be used to finance the reskilling. We don't know. It's like dancing with somebody in the dark, standing in the dark. You know, you from. And the issue is that you tango. I mean, the Argentinians will tell you can never tango in the dark. You must always keep the light on, because otherwise you're going to tap on each other's toes and somebody's going to fall. So we don't know really. Your job is to get to know, and on the basis of that, we will then get to know, then we can kind of give you more understanding of it. We don't know. In fact, it is conceivable that private markets that's in the business actually knows more than what the government knows. Now, I can only say that it's the reasons for that, based on my own experiences. But you can demand that stuff. I mean, you can tell somebody from the committee that we want information from you within 48 hours. That's what I did with this one. If I don't get the information from you within 48 hours, I'm going to the president. Or I'm telling the minister not to speak to the president. There's nothing I'll be able to. And then that information comes like anything to you.
Emotional blackmail.
That's why some of us have got blue eyes sometimes. I don't think we want to respond on the efficiency and the corruption stuff and that, because there is a cost, there's an economic cost to corruption that needs to be worked on. I don't think we've actually adequately worked on what's the economic cost to fraud, corruption, wastage, and very much on that. On the issue of the ESCOM chair CEO, I think it's a material matter, and I think all that we would say to you, sorry, Honourable Chairperson, is that, I mean, this committee in itself needs to have a legal person, its own one. But your legal unit needs to see whether the CEO Chairperson does it fits with the ESCOM SOC legislation. Two, whether it fits with the PFMA. Three, whether it fits with the company law. If it complies with it, if it doesn't, then it means somebody is in contravention of the law. And I don't know that, because we haven't looked at that. We're only raising the governance question of having one person dealing with both. But if it doesn't fit, then it means we can't have government contravening its own laws. It's just not going to work. So I would say that at first would be, before you even look at this going forward, is also to get the legal unit of Parliament to give a statement on it, either by the state or advisor or themselves, as to whether this is compliance with the law. Because political rationality is going to do with the balance of power. But legislative rationality is going to do with compliance. There's no way out of it. So I would say that there's a the issue that was raised by Imam Sheikh, I've made my point about that. The draft conditions, I've answered the Honourable Number 4, Sarapan. our advice is that you can't get into those conditions. The 10 billion, then why are we raising it all the time? It's part of the ESCOM story. We can't deny that. And for the record, let me just correct something. I said the Israel Kutswa. And I could sense the heat playing on the other side from an honorable member. In fact, I got the name wrong. It's actually Malutuba. But the point that we were just making there, in fact, more than 60% of those that own ESCOM, those of the six, of the 10, 11 billion rand from the Free State. The majority is there from the Free State. The only point that we're making there is that all those who owe debt to ESCOM and aren't able to pay, it's part of the ESCOM debtors book. And if you go to your potential loaner, the person is going to borrow you the money, you need to present what is your debtors book, and the debtors book also gets seen as forward-going income assets that's going to be collected. That's the point that we're making. The other point that we're making also is that there is this problem that it would be great if you ask, so why can't some of these debt be signed off, given that you continuously rely on government special appropriations, interventions, or ESCOM, but you're not dealing with us. I mean, it's just illogical that we continuously rescue over the years, all mid-presidents, all terms, ESCOM gets rescued, but not municipalities. But the coal fades of governance in the country. Some of them, most of them, others are not sometimes. We spoke about the accountability. I'm almost like chairperson because we will come. I'm going to ask Shane to speak on the ratings that somebody wanted to know. I thought the honourable member, one honourable member, seven, Mangwa, raised the issue about soft conditions, consequent management, management of government guarantees. Here's the thing that I think is important, that it always comes late. The media got in first before accountability stepped in. The media got in first before accountability stepped in. This time around, I think you need to step in first before the media get there. So that you know, and then you are actually able to respond to what comes out of it. I think that is problematic. In fact, the Americans used to say that the media stepped in first before help could get there, especially in business situations. Evaluation criteria for Parliament, we agree. It needs to be based on the conditionalities. It needs to be based as possible. But you're going to have to also consider, Honourable Chairperson, that the capabilities are under this committee. Because there's data sets and data things that need to be developed to be able to. I mean, there's one thing to say, yes, you've got a content advisor and a researcher, but you're setting him up for failure in terms of that. On the IPPs, I think this sheet, Honourable Chairperson and members, I'm asking, suggesting to you to ask your administrative support team to print this for you. It's table 11. It's on the Treasury website. And the reason why I'm saying that to you, the exposure of IPPs is 147 billion rand. 147 billion rand. Guarantees that was covered on the, in terms of the guarantees. So you add that to it and it goes, so 174 plus 47 plus 297, that's close to 500.
400. So it's quite huge.
What's that?
It's government guarantees. It's the table I read to you earlier, right? So the Eskom government guarantee for 2018. Let me read you the 2019 one, then we end this year. The Eskom government guarantee for this year is 306.784. 3.7 billion or 0.8 billion. The Eskom. On independent power producers, it's 154.7 billion. Table 11, we speak to net loan provisions and contingency liabilities, and it's got three categories. The one is provisions, it's got a large category on contingent liabilities. Of the biggest share of that is guarantees, which runs from agricultural cooperatives to universities and technical colleges. Okay? I think that's quite critical to I hope I answered the whole thing about we can't say to you, remember we give policy evidence based on our research, because we constitutionally put together to do research for government, in particular parliament, and our parliament. We can't say to you whether the unbundling of Eskom is going to lead to privatization or to greater efficiency. That's why I put the two to you for you to look at, because until we know exactly the content of the unbundling, one will be able to speak much more confidently in our advice to you around that. And the whole thing about Eskom and borrowing and rating agencies. You see, the rating of rating agencies is what we've accepted as part of the global markets interaction with the African domestic market. So many will argue that the rating agencies are extremely political and it's allowed to do this thing. But then you have a huge economy like the US, where the government deficit is over 400%. The government deficit is over 400%. But they're a top rate institution. And then I can take you to Russia, which is quite a bad rating, and the deficit to its budget is at 123%. So you need to think through that, but many has argued that it's not based on objective facts, it's got to do with the balance of power in the global environment. Chair, can I just ask Cheng to quickly talk to you the specific question on the status of the rating agencies. So I ask him to talk to you about what is the rating of Eskom and what's the rating of South Africa, so you can see the interconnect of the two pictures. On all the others, what we can do is come back to you, and depending on the time that this process has, because we don't know when you want to conclude this process, Chairperson, we will be able to give you additional comments based on the questions that are asked.
Okay, so thank you, Honourable Chair Nandis. So in terms of the credit status...
Sorry, before you come in, so that you can also address the Honourable cases.
Oh.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I am going back to the question that I originally asked. It has not been answered. I've heard you, Professor, bringing in the issue of apartheid into Eskom, and bringing the Israeli push. Now I pose the question. It's usually put outside the apartheid picture or inside it. And why is it excluded from that understanding of apartheid? Because you said is the only municipality fine that is now at the $3 billion something like that. That is being owed to ESCOM and it can't pay it. It can only do it through deficit. It's fine. It has got a problem that area. Now you bring in the apartheid issue. That's where I don't want to move away from it. You brought in apartheid. How does apartheid talk to that area of visual input?
Can I say something? You probably noticed from my skin color and my own political history and some organization that I wasn't the inventor of apartheid. The point I was making, and I did say it's not real, that was the first thing that I corrected, because I just checked my slides, but it's not before. The point I'm making is that some of the debt that's owned by municipalities are debt that carried through from the apartheid years. Okay? And
sorry,
and
Professor, I think that is a statement that is problematic.
Can
I
finish my point?
It was not conclusive.
No. I'm saying to you again.
Sorry, before Prof. will come in, let's allow Prof. to give his responses. We may not agree with them, and we'll take it afterwards and see how we progress.
Okay. I might not give you a political answer. The point I'm making
is Oost Coast.
Oh, France Coast, but in the Bechat. There's debt incurred by municipalities at the time of President Mandela's presidency. We still had municipalities in the range differently. We have thousands of municipalities. Okay? The municipal landscape started changing around 95, 96, but more importantly were the first elections of what was called a democratic developmental municipality. And that time it was thousands. Those thousands came down to around 100,000 and then it came down to around 800 and up. We are standing in 2019 with 257 municipalities.
Yeah.
So, as municipalities were grouped together, amalgamated, that liability, that burden on the citizens of that municipality didn't go away. It was an ongoing liability, what we call a contingent liability. So if you want to unbundle all of that, I'm suggesting that the best people to do that, because it didn't work, it's cocked up. They must come and tell you exactly how that debt works. So there is an element of historic, there's an element of current, and there's an element of bad management and signing wrong contractual agreements. That's the point that I was trying to make, and I'm sorry. Sometimes we're raising these things with the idea that we put the helping to paint the canvas on its honorable member. Chairperson, you asked on efficiency gains before I go into the stream. I think some of the questions that in fact, you answered yourself on the efficiency gains. You raised the issue of contract management. You raised the issue of the role of the IPP relative to ESCOM as the provider, the loan repayments, the supply issues, the issue about delivering that. So those are all efficiency issues that we have to consider. I can't respond to the special bread winner status. All I know is like that's a new phrase that I've heard in the corridors of Parliament. I like it. We like it. What is the plan to defend? You got a 3-year plan. I think there is an issue. Arrest this thing, like we used to talk in the past. Arrest this thing. Get them, whoever comes here, give them 3 notices. My advice is give them notices now already. What is the plan? And if the plan is linked to the administrative conditions that you have in the current system of administration, then clearly somebody has not been thinking and they want 59 billion rand for not thinking. And I think you guys need to use the legislation for it.
Thank you, Honourable Chair members. Okay, so in terms of the credit rating status, obviously that is an important indicator for the fundraising capability of ESCOM. So in terms of ESCOM, it's pretty dismal. Standard & Poor gave a significant speculative grade, junk status by Moody, and Fitch, also a junk grade. Basically what these indicators mean for especially fund managers is that, and also the fundraising capability of ESCOM, is that going forward, some certain funds will not be able to, even if they wanted to, even if by some miracle that unless they change the terms of the fund and contract thereof, that they can't invest in it simply because it's too speculative, risky, and potentially damaging to their portfolio diversification. And then in support, but for South Africa, we are sub-investment from all two except Moody, which still gave us just one last grade of investment grade, worthy grade. If I may, Chairperson and members, I also want to just highlight one point for you. What does this all mean in terms of our fiscal framework and in terms of our medium-term budget and thereof? And it has to do with also the financial governance, budgeting credibility of the fiscus. And so you remember that a year ago there was that fiscal consolidation that was implemented, whereby the provincial conditional grants were contracting, right, were reduced, and then made it into a contingency provision and at the national level. Then there was this year's budget, the 2019 appropriation, which used that money that was re-centralized and fiscal expansion the total amount is 26 billion, and then 23 billion of that 26 was for restructuring of ESCOM. And so the picture here is really one of re-centralizing, and then therefore the impact of this ESCOM and the financial sort of questions of financial sustainability is really starting to affect the overall fiscal sustainability of the country. So there is re-centralization, forced, right? Forced, and fiscal expansion. And then going, obviously, forward since then, and which makes this special appropriation somewhat problematic in terms of financial governance, and which simply raising here to caution honourable members and chair to continue looking at this, because then remember after the 23 billion from which we had the section 16 story, and then the now special appropriation of this 29, and it's a problem. Why? Because in the 18-19 financial year, if you look into the budget review book, there was ESCOM actually advanced, okay, 50 billion over the government guarantee. Okay, so one starts to do some number adding and then sort of just see that it does seem rather unlikely that this 23 billion that's then put in place and then plus the 29 just for this year is going to do anything other than whatever that 50 billion excess or advance that was used for. And what was that 50 billion that was already used last year, meaning that it's likely to carry on this year? It was actually just the same reason as for the National Treasury said for Section 16, which was to rescue the liquidity crunch at ESCOM. So really, the condition and the success rate of looking at the conditions of this special appropriation must be carefully examined. I shall stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Prof. and to the team, honorable members. Prof. One worry, well, on top of many other worries, when you say that ESCOM can't even cover its interest rate payment, it's a big problem. That's not even about the redemption of the debt, can't even cover the interest payment, because what it means is that we'll be appropriating to cover the interest, not even to do any of these things that we want to do, but that's fine, I'm sure we'll deal with that. Just a few comments, Prof. Will you then send us an updated presentation factoring in the changes that you're going to make? Number two, tomorrow the values M46 starting at 10. M46, we have got another one, my change to M46, I'm sure it's a bigger venue. Right. And lastly, you know, we said we need a swift time as the committee to digest what we have been bombarded with by many people, including National Treasury, the Professor C P D O. So, but we are going to send this one up. We are thinking that on Wednesday next week, after public hearings, we think there are only two people who said want to talk to us. I think after that, we then need to stay behind and just consider this and say, with all this information and the discussions that we've had, how do we chart our way forward, right? So I think that's what will be happening. But the meeting is stands adjourned, and thank you very much, FFC. Okay.